Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the folks about Santa Fe Complex and their opening that's coming up there. And we're going to be speaking to Jason Yursik and Angela Jaramillo about the play Little Ghost. Right now, I would like to welcome Mark David Gerson. He is the author of the books Moon Quest, A True Fantasy, and The Voice of the Muse, Answering the Call to Write. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
And I should say that you are an award-winning author. You were named a gold medal IPPY winner in the Independent Publishers Book Awards for your book Moon Quest.
Yes, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So, let's talk about this whole process of writing, which you talk about in your book, about writing, The Voice of the Muse. You talk about something called the Muse Stream. There's a lot of water metaphors in your work about writing.
Well, of course, creativity in writing is about flow, so it is a perfect metaphor. I guess my whole philosophy, and actually the Moon Quest was written like that, is that all we need to do is surrender to that new stream, to that flow of words that is already within us, to the stories that are already within or around us, and just, in effect, let them have their way with us.
How did you learn to do that?
Well, it's funny. When I was younger, I hated writing. I hated English class more than any other class in school. And I think my issue was one of being judged. I was always afraid of being judged. So, when I was earlier in my professional life, I was a freelance writer, freelance editor, freelance journalist, and I was working at a magazine one day, and one of my fellow editors said, "There's this writing class you have to take," and I said no, because my image was everyone stands up, reads their work, gets shot down, and you leave with your tail between your legs. And she said, "It's not like that at all." So I went and took the class ultimately. I gave in. And it wasn't like that at all. It was very nurturing, very supportive, and it really gave me the foundation both for how I write and how I teach.
So what did they do in that class that was so different than anything you'd known before?
Basically, the process was about supporting the writer in his or her creative process, not about being smart or clever. And that's really, I think, what I try to do when I teach and in the Voice of the Muse, is I really try to, whatever I do is to support you in your creativity, and it's not about me showing off. It's about me doing whatever I can to support you to grow as a writer and produce better work.
So there's this idea that the story that you have to tell or that somebody has to tell already exists in a parallel dimension.
Yeah, my feeling is that, in a sense, everything exists around us. In the ethers around us, another dimension, if you will, and all we're really doing when we're writing is tapping into that, and it's like a manifestation technique when you're working with money. It's taking what's etheric and making it physical. So you're taking the energy of a story, which isn't words on a page. It's just an energy. It's a concept. It's an idea, and you can talk about it in etheric terms. You can talk about it neural impulses in your brain, and you're translating that. You're interpreting that energy into words. And one of my concepts is, because you're doing that, it's never going to be perfect.
Perfection. Let's talk about that.
Okay. Yeah, it's never going to be perfect because you're dealing with two different media. You're dealing with an energetic medium which has no physicality. And you're taking it and creating words on a page. So by doing that, by definition, it doesn't translate directly. It can't be perfect, which is very liberating. If you realize from the start it's never going to be perfect, then you don't bang your head against it quite so much. You just do the best you can.
Yeah, who was it? We had an author on the air not too long ago whom we asked, "When do you know the book is done?" He said, "When the publisher wants it."
Well, I mean, you know, I was giving a talk at Hastings in Albuquerque a few days ago, and somebody, one of the questions was, you know, I never stop. I just keep working on this over and over and over again. I said, you know, you've, at a certain point, you've got to stop, or the next book never comes. You could work on the same paragraph for the rest of your life, and then nothing, and you get stuck. So basically, you take it as far as you can take it, recognizing that, you know, it's a photograph in time. It's never, it's as good as you can make it as who you are when you're complete. And then it's time to move on to something else.
Now, you talk in your book, and this is something that probably many of our listeners have also encountered in the work of Natalie Goldberg and her books about writing, is shutting off the inner censor, the inner editor, all the sense of judgment that comes from without. And you do that through different techniques. First of all, what's wrong with editing?
There's nothing wrong with editing. Editing is very, very important. But there's a time and a place for editing. What happens when we edit as we write, not always, and kind of the caveat there is that if you can edit while you write and not let your editor be in charge, then it's fine. It's just a question of who's going to take charge of each process. When you're writing, when you're in the flow, when you're in a place of surrender to the story, if your editor is often in that place, a fearful part of yourself that says, you know, this is kind of dangerous, I don't think we should go there, or people are going to laugh at you, or stuff like that. And that pulls you out of the easy flow of creativity and gets you into a place of second-guessing and self-judgment. And so if you can edit while you're right and not go there, more power to you. Most people, for most people, what happens is all the second-guessing comes in, all the self-criticism comes in, all the years of having been beat up, for whatever reason they've been beat up, come in, and the creativity gets stunted. So what I say is, let the flow happen, and when you've got something down, then you go back and you edit it. And my whole attitude toward editing is a little different, too, because it's really, for me, it's like a whole body, whole brain approach. It's not just, you know, taking the hatchet and going at it. It's really using your intuitive abilities, using all your senses, including your intuitive senses. And really, in fact, I try to use the word revision instead of editing, because for me, the editing process is revisiting your vision and doing everything you can in a very gentle, self-nurturing, and respectful way to hone and polish and shape the work so that it aligns with your original vision.
We're talking to Mark David Gerson. So there are some things you do in that you talk about in the book, namely actual meditation exercises. Mm-hmm. Do those work?
They work if you're open. They work to the extent that you're open to them working, and that's true for any technique. We can, to the extent that we're prepared to surrender to any technique, it'll work for us. To the extent that we're resistant, then it's not. Some people meditate more easily than others. You don't have to meditate to use the book. There are some meditations in the book which I believe are helpful, but you can certainly use the book without them.
Now, what is writer's block?
Writer's block, well, it depends on how you're asking the question. The way writer's block is normally defined is you're stuck and can't go anywhere.
Right.
Either because you've lost your talent or because the words won't come. My attitude is that, yes, we all get stuck, but we don't get stuck because we have no talent. We don't get stuck because the words won't come. We get stuck because we may not be on the right track, and we get stuck because we're not surrendering to the words that want to come.
And I heard a writer say that in her experience, writer's block was always lack of information. And if she figured out what the piece of information was that was missing and actually did the research, even if it was fiction, mm-hmm. then the words would come.
And that, I mean, there are many ways in and through writer's block, depending on what the cause is. One of the causes can be that you're not ready to continue. When I wrote The Moon Quest, I stopped for about 5 months. Not because I was stuck, because life got in the way.
Right.
And when I went back to it, I was scared that I had bypassed it and realized that life had gotten in the way because I wasn't ready. And I needed those life experiences to catch up with a story that was way beyond who I had been. So writer's block can come from a place where we're stuck because we're not where the story is yet. So that's
very interesting.
That's one way. So we have to, again, it's all about discernment and just being open to what the various causes can be.
Now, there's the whole set of ideas about, you know, being free, letting it flow, meditating, not self-censoring. And I find myself wondering, would you say this to somebody who is trying to learn the violin? You know, just pick up the bow any way you want and, you know, scrape it across any strings you choose. Well, no, it's about technique. It's incredibly rigorous.
There is certainly, you have to be able to know how to string a sentence together. The difference between writing a book and learning the violin is that, the similarity is practice is important. It's important to keep writing. It's important to keep reading because that's one of the ways you learn. But you can go back and edit your book, your work, after the fact. The violinist goes on stage and that's it. So you have more space as a writer than you do as a performer.
Oh, that's an interesting distinction. Now, do you think everybody can really write, or is it, like the violin, a gift?
I think everybody is innately creative. I think that everybody can write. I don't necessarily believe that everyone can write a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, but I think everyone has the ability to touch something deep within themselves and bring out something that will touch other people.
And you've taught quite a lot of writing classes.
I have, and I have taught classes where people come in saying that they can't write, and they walk out touching people, they walk in thinking what they write is awful, and are convinced by sharing what they've written with other people, and having touched those people, that perhaps it's not so bad after all.
So one of the things that I thought was interesting in your book was set easy goals, because a lot of people set themselves up for failure by saying, I'm going to write from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. every morning, and then on the first day they don't do it.
And then they beat themselves up, and that's the end of it. Yeah, I think, you know, we're so trained in our society to beat ourselves up for our failures, but not to celebrate our successes. And so this is really a technique for setting us up for success rather than for failure. So if all you think you can do is write 3 words a week, then do that and you'll feel better. If you set yourself up to write
three words, I'd call that an easy goal.
Yeah, but if you set yourself up to write 3,000 words and you don't do it, you'll feel awful.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm exaggerating, obviously, but if we set ourselves up to succeed, success builds upon success, and before long we are doing that 3,000 words because we feel good about ourselves and we feel good about the process and the project.
So how did you go from being a freelance writer and writing for deadlines and clients and so on to writing fiction?
I stopped to be a freelance writer. You don't have to do that, but I stopped completely. I mean, I went cold turkey. I couldn't be writing other people's stuff and editing other people's stuff and doing my own.
So what kind of writing were you doing?
I was doing magazine and newspaper writing. Basically, again, other people's ideas to other people's deadlines, and really not connecting with anything inside of me, which doesn't mean you can't be doing that work and making those connections. I wasn't doing it.
So tell us about your book, The Moon Quest. It's called A True Fantasy.
Sure.
What does that mean?
Well, a couple of ways of looking at that. One is that my philosophy is that fiction can be truer than fact, because fiction touches us at very deep places and allows us to have our own experience of the words. Fact just kind of says, here it is. When we read fiction, we again go to deep places within ourselves. The story really, though I didn't know this when I was writing it, fortunately, is kind of, for me, it was a metaphor for my own creative awakening. It's a story about a mythical land. It is a fantasy where stories have been banned, where storytellers have been banished or more likely put to death, and where there is no vision or imagination in the land. And that, in a sense, was who I was. In writing the story, in very much the way that I had already been teaching writing, which was I had no clue what I was doing, or where the story was going, or where it was taking me. I just allowed myself to have the story be in the driver's seat and be in the passenger seat and go along for the journey.
That's a lot of trust.
It's a lot of trust.
It's in that thing that we talked about before, namely kind of the pre-existing story.
Right. Well, you know, the both books kind of snuck up on me. I did not plan to write either of them. The Moon Quest actually happened for me when I was teaching a writing class. And for some reason that I still don't quite understand, when I had my students teach doing the exercise, I did it too. I never do that. That day I did. And what came out was the first scene of the first draft of this story. And what possessed me to keep going, I can't even tell you today, but I did. And the story evolved. And I didn't know the title until about halfway through. I didn't know how it was going to end until probably about three-quarters of the way through.
Well, and that's not true for every author.
Of course not.
Some novelists, they have sort of a sense of the whole before they start.
Absolutely. And in The Voice of the Muse, there are various rules for different kinds of writing, and the first rule always is there are no rules. So, you know, my technique works for certain people in certain situations, and it doesn't mean that it's going to work all the time. I'm working on a sequel to The Moon Quest, and I have more of an idea where that's going than I did with The Moon Quest, which
right.
was a total exercise in absolute trust. And very stressful. You know, if you're a recovering control freak, then that kind of surrender is very much a profound life experience as well.
Well, there was a great symbol of that from your own life, where you decided at a certain point in your life that you just felt the call to get in your car and move from where you were, didn't know where you were going. And it was very stressful, as you write in your book. And then suddenly you end up at a place, say, I think I'll stay here. And next thing you know, you're married with children.
Yes. Well, in fact, writing The Moon Quest, because I'd written most of the drafts, the early drafts before that, in effect freed me to do that. So the experience of having to have that deep level of trust in the creative process made it possible for me to have that kind of trust in my life process.
And to do things, then find yourself in places that you never would have found
Absolutely.
If you'd been rational about sort of life decision making.
Absolutely. You know, my thesis is that, you know, our imagination is limited by what we know and what we can see and our experiences. And The Moon Quest and much of my life since I wrote it has really gone way beyond anything I could have imagined.
And so are these books available locally here
yes.
in Santa Fe?
Yes. The Moon Quest and The Voice of the Muse are available at both Border stores. And Collected Works. The Voice of the Muse is only available at Collected Works right now in town, and also through Amazon.
And you will be speaking in Rio Rancho.
I will on June 26th at 6:30. I'm giving a talk through the Teen Library, but it's open to everybody, called The Evolution of a Writer. And I'll be talking about how I wrote The Moon Quest and my philosophy of writing. And if there's time and interest, maybe even doing a little bit of a writing exercise for people who are there.
Oh, great. Mark David Gerson is the author of The Moon Quest, A True Fantasy, and The Voice of the Muse, Answering the Call to Write. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Don Begley. He is the managing director of Santa Fe Complex, and Orlando Leibovitz, who's an artist. And there's an opening at Santa Fe Complex this Saturday, the 14th of June, called Emergence, the Interaction of Science and Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you very much.
Now, Santa Fe Complex, we've talked about it a little bit on this show in the past, but what is this complex?
It's a place. It's a community store, if you will, for people in Santa Fe to come together, explore art, science, public policy, although that's kind of a big word. We don't like to use that word too much.
Why not? And
because it's got all those connotations of think tanks and whatnot, and we want to be much more dynamic, but there are public policy implications of the work that we can do at Santa Fe Complex. The primary concern is to bring together people from the art community, from the science community, students, and return perhaps to the College of Arts and Sciences, make these things work together once again.
Now, it's interesting because there's an art and science series going on at the Santa Fe Institute. You are bringing art and science together. What are the common threads between scientists and artists?
I think, Mary, that creativity is a common thread. I think if you, for example, analyze creativity, let's say, with theoretical physicists and with artists. Certainly, physicists have a different constraint on them because what they do has to match what we would call the real world, and not so with an artist. But the actual theorizing or the actual creating of an original artwork, I think, is very similar, whether you're an artist or a scientist. I also think that the relationship of art and science has always been with us. It's just that it's getting more attention now. People are having a yearning for it. There's a certain amount of synthesis that takes place when you take mediums, art and science, whatever the mediums are, that normally don't go together and put them together. What you get is something unusual, something original. And I think for me, that is what has drawn me to the complex, the fact that I've spoken to Don and others about the metaphor for me, or the analogy for me, of the complex is that it's an estuary. And an estuary is where salt water and fresh water meet. And when they meet, it's a special environment, and life forms emerge in that environment that you don't have either in salt water or fresh water. And sometimes there are new life forms that emerge. And I see that very much as the thing that drew me to the complex, the fact that people are willing to come together from disparate places and just kind of act together, collaborate together, and see what happens next. That's very important for me as an artist, and I think it's, personally, I feel it's very important for the world to go more in that direction.
So taking the estuary metaphor, how does that play out in your own work?
Well, I think that when you think about new life forms being created, it's not exactly the same as artistic creativity, but it is the same as an artist going into a studio, or in this case, an artist, me, coming to the complex and meeting with people who have certain technological solutions to artwork that I've been working on and have been unable to resolve. And, you know, I go to the complex and I mention something, and five people jump up and say, yeah, that's a great idea. We can help you with that. That's a wonderful thing to be able to bring artists and scientists and people who are technologically proficient together to accomplish those kinds of things that they couldn't accomplish separately.
What's the nature of your work?
Well, it's pretty diverse. Up until a few years ago, it was mainly, I would say, imaginative, figurative work. But the work that will be shown at the complex has to do with kind of a collaging of music and painting together. I call them musical paintings. And they're simultaneously musical manuscripts and paintings. I've invented a rudimentary musical language so that you can actually read the paintings. After I finished them, I worked with a friend who's a Juilliard-trained composer, and we added a harmony and put it on CD. That we hope to have some of it playing so that people, when they step in front of the paintings, can hear the music and have kind of an interaction between the painting and the music. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, in the sense that here is an attempt anyway, whether it's successful or not, at taking two mediums, two things that normally you would not put together, and then getting something out of them that's quite different. I find a lot of that happening at the complex.
There's some really basic distinctions between art and science in the sense of their goals. I mean, for science, you're looking for factual physical truth, and in art there is an emotional and spiritual and heart component that doesn't exist in science, and in fact you kind of have to excise out of science. Is that not true?
Well, it's partially true. It's true that science, let's again talk about physics, which I've been doing some reading about, has time constraints of what might be, has constraints of what might be called the real world. And unlike an artist who can be inspired and call something spiritual, if a physicist is describing, in theory, the behavior of an electron, it has to be borne out experimentally, which is different. On the other hand, I think you would get many scientists to agree that Einstein was as much an artist as he was a theoretical physicist. I think that he had a style, which was his way of thinking. And I think that, in my opinion, you could find a number of other scientists in the various fields who, by themselves or other scientists, would consider them they're consider what they're doing to be as much an art form as a scientific form. That's a big thing right now that's happening, to see whether that what I said is really possible or not. That there is a controversy over that, but I think you will find people who agree that there is a synthesis there.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, I think, because it seems that you can be emotionally immature, spiritually non-existent, and utterly heartless, and still be an excellent scientist.
Well, I don't know. You might be able to say the same thing about being an artist, you know.
Not really.
Well, Hitler painted landscapes, so...
Yeah, but nobody says he was a good artist or that his landscapes were good.
Well, you just introduced the word good.
Well, yeah. That's what
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you can be a good scientist, and a lot of scientists peak very young, and there's no actual emotional maturity there
or
kindness or anything.
Well, that is a difference. The fact that most scientists do their work at an earlier age, as opposed to artists, some of whom do it at an earlier age, but a lot who kind of mature as time goes by, I think that is a big difference. You know, people are people. I think there are emotionally immature artists who are great and emotionally immature artists who are bad, and you could say the same thing about scientists or managing directors of the complex.
Yeah, absolutely.
To personalize this particular conversation.
Yes, or maybe even people who do radio programs. But
well, let's talk about Santa Fe Complex. What are the actual projects? And it's a brand new thing, and so it's coming together each day, and it's sort of evolving, to use a science term.
Emerging. Would be the word we'd want to use.
Okay.
Yes.
What are some of the actual projects that you're doing?
Well, I can mention a couple, but I'd like to offer you a preamble first, which is that if you do believe in emergence as a philosophy, and if you do believe in bottom-up, putting things together from the lowest levels and building blocks and making them bigger and bigger, whether it's art or science, then you have to let go of some preconceptions about how things should be, and just be willing to go with the flow of who shows up and what happens. And so with that as a caveat, by that I mean I can't determine what's going to happen there any more than Orlando can determine in advance what's going to happen in one of his paintings. It grows as he works with it. I think that's a fair statement to make.
I'd start out with a general idea, but yes, you're right.
We're doing a lot of work right now, particularly in the educational area and with interns. Education is a key component of our mission. We very much want to work with the high schools and junior college and College of Santa Fe and Santa Fe Community College. We believe very much in hands-on work, in intern work, as opposed to classroom work. And so we've got some interns who have done things like model in three dimensions the Santa Fe ski area and use that for projects.
Now, when you say model in three dimensions, you're not talking about a piece of paper mache on a piece of plywood.
No, we aren't. What we're actually talking about is something we call a sand table, which is a box filled with sand that can be
sculpted.
So
it's a bunch of sand on a piece of plywood.
That's right. And we all like to play in sandboxes. You know, we've always enjoyed sandboxes from the earliest ages. In this case, a projector is used. We use a projector to beam down onto the sand and record levels of the sand to create a topography. And that's what the kids are doing, is writing the software to be able to read the sand and model, see whether or not they are modeling correctly the actual physical dimensions of the ski basin, and then shadow it. Make it look just like a topographical map with shadows and sunshine, and you can change the sun to the position of the sun during the course of the day.
So what's the purpose of that?
Well, the short-term purpose is for them to learn how to do this, because that's a career or an interest in either one of those two cases. The more practical, applicable purpose is things like fire rescue or different types of emergency management. If you know, for an example, what the topography of the terrain is, you know the rules by which fires operate, which is they go uphill, the wind pushes them, etc., then you can actually model a fire. You can model the emergency response to it. You can have on the computer vehicles, people, resources, and see what happens if you set a counterflame, a backflame, whatever they call it in the fire business, at this location as opposed to that location with the wind blowing from the northeast at 40 miles an hour. So all of that is variable, and all of that is eminently practical and practicable for those planners.
Now, you are bringing complexity or chaos theory into the kind of calculations that you use to make a model of the ski area. How's that different from the modeling that went before?
Modeling that went before is predominantly static, and that's what really the reason I made that comment earlier about bottom-up. If you, in older types of modeling, you would decide from the top end what something is supposed to look like, and you'd write a computer program to create that result. This type of modeling says, all I know are the variables. All I know are the agents, the things that are going to act in one way or another in the model. I'm going to tell them to go do things and see what happens. Peter Jackson, I've been told by a screenwriter, found out that in reviewing one of his scenes in one of the Lord of the Rings movies, that a whole bunch of orcs broke off from the back of an army and ran away. They made that decision independently based upon the rules in the computer programs that generated the battle scenes.
Very interesting.
And so that's bottom up. That's letting the individual components of a scenario, of a model, of a whatever, do something and interact with each other.
I think that's also creativity. That's an artist starting with some parameters but not really knowing what the finished art object is going to look like. I think that is Einstein thinking about light and time and space in its disparate parts and then coming up with relativity. So that's kind of a non-science way of looking at it, but those are the relationships that I make.
What kind of work are you going to actually be displaying at this opening, Orlando Leibovitz?
I'll be displaying some of the musical paintings and some keyboard paintings, which are piano keyboards that are abstracted down to their kind of abstracted down to their geometric essence. And with a lot of color added, because I think if you're talking about painting and music, you're talking about sound and light. And so really a lot of what these paintings are about is sound and light and whatever personal relationships I'm creating between them and possibly if there are other relationships that exist beyond me as an artist, trying to kind of see what they are.
John Begley, yes. There's a number of other artists as well.
There are. We're really blessed in this neighborhood. There's something called the Santa Fe Approach to Complexity on the science side, which is world-renowned as a way of doing modeling and
meaning
science.
Do it tomorrow?
Well, yeah, sometimes it feels like that, especially when you're opening on Saturday. We also have a lot of very gifted artists. Locally, we have Orlando, we have Woody Vasulka, who's going to be there. Woody has been in the digital art field all of his career, from back into the 1960s. Out of Albuquerque, a younger person named Jared Tarbell is coming up. Jared is on the road right now at different conferences talking about digital art. He calls himself a solar-powered bipedal brain tower, whatever that means. But Jared does some beautiful, wonderful work, and his work is all open source. You can go to his website and download the code and make your own paintings using what he has there. A couple other quick names to mention. We're really going to be fortunate to have Paul Pariski, who does a lot of photography from his interest as a naturalist and environmentalist working with the United Nations. He created national parks in Haiti, for an example. And
David Stout
and Corey Metcalf from the College of Santa Fe. David is on our board, incidentally, and one of the prime movers behind what we're trying to do. They have a group they call Noisefold, and Noisefold will close out the evening. We have basically an open house from 4 until 6:30. At 6:30, we'll have a couple of presentations about what we are, what we do. And then David and Corey, as Noisefold, will close the evening out. They do something that I don't know how to explain. It's a totally interactive, on their part, digital and audio presentation that if you sit there and you watch it, you are going to be in for a roller coaster ride.
And David Costa-Mayer will be there and make some introductory remarks. I think he's pretty impressed with what the concept is or what he knows of the complex. So he will be there as well.
And so all of this is happening on Saturday, June 14th. from 4 to 8 in the evening. That's a nice long time. There will be refreshments and all sorts of good things. It's called Emergence, the Interaction of Science and Art. It's at 632 Agua Fria Street. That's Santa Fe Complex. There's more information at sfcomplex.org. And is there a phone number people can call for more information?
There is, 216-7562.
216-7562. Don Begley is Managing Director of Santa Fe Complex. Orlando Leibovitz is an artist. We will see you on Saturday night.
Thank you very much.
See you there.
We're going to take another little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Jason Yersic and Angelo Jaramillo. They are going to, Jason is the author of the play, or the playwright of the play, The Little Ghost, and Angelo is an actor in this play that is happening this weekend, Friday through Sunday. Welcome.
Thank you.
And now, this is at the Armory for the Arts. Let's talk about it. First of all, why don't we start with the name of the play, Little Ghost?
Yes, the name Little Ghost. I love that name. It was given to me by a street gang back when I was probably 7 years old, and it stuck with me all my life, but I've kept it secretly hidden far, far away, because one of the main characters of the gang, one of the leaders of the gang, if you would, was a man they called Mighty, and he said, "Little Ghost, you got to fly under the radar. You can't let people know that you're with us, and you got to go out there and since you're half white and you're half Mexican, you got to go out there and show us what the other half of the world is doing and what they think about us." So he named me Little Ghost, and he told me, "Stay under the radar."
And so this is the real life that you were living at that time, and you then have written a play. How autobiographical is this play?
I like to say that it is all real, except for the stuff I made up. But it's really close. I'd probably say 95% is completely true. But, you know, it's for the theater, and we have to embellish in some areas, make it interesting, more interesting, rather.
Dramatic structure around
right,
it.
Exactly.
So what's the play about?
The play is about a young boy who grows up without a father. He struggles to find his identity out on the streets. He's impressed upon by the gang and by drug life and by violence to go in that direction, and he decides that through turmoil, inner turmoil and hard times in his life, physical life, he decides that he needs to go into a spiritual path, and he slowly is edged into the spiritual path by a ghost figure, if you would, another level. It's the physical form of the poetic muse, and he's played by the man, Froggy Fernandez, right? Yeah, Froggy Fernandez, and he propels the character Emiliano forward into poetry.
Now, this was originally a screenplay that you were working on, and then you decided to change it into a theater play.
Yes. I was Googling, and I was looking for a way to pay my electric bill, because I didn't have any money to pay my electric bill.
You were Googling, how do I pay my electric bill?
I was Googling literary projects on how it would pay me money for, and I found the screenwriting or the playwriting competition that they have up here at the Santa Fe Performing Arts, and I entered my screenplay because it's all I had, and they accepted it, and Nicholas Sabato worked with me on making it fit for the theater.
And he's the director of this play.
Yes.
Now, you play, Angelo, the lead role, the little ghost, is that right?
That's correct.
So, How did you find yourself relating to that role, which is Jason's life?
Well, it's like kind of multi-tiered as far as the different levels that the way this role affects me. Because on the one hand, although I was never immersed in that kind of extreme kind of street life, growing up here in Santa Fe, I kind of drifted towards just kind of like the recklessness and kind of like the wildness. And then coming from the Chicano background of, you know, kind of like living with the guys who were, you know, growing up in the barrio and kind of associated with gang life, I saw a lot of friends and some relatives who kind of went down that path, so I could relate in that sense as far as knowing the stories that kind of incorporate that. And just in addition to what Jason said about how autobiographical it is, he kind of mentioned to me that, you know, this is like 20 years of secrets or something like that, and it's a combination of all kinds of different cats and characters all into these five different, well, these two primary characters, myself and little Freddy, who's my antagonist. But as the writing aspect of it, I mean, that just hit home right away, and after I read the script the first time, I knew I wanted to be a part of it. I actually discovered Jason's books at St. John's College before I even knew about the play, before Nicolas Sabato called me up and invited me to participate. And so I could relate to him and what he was saying and kind of just what he was about as far as his soul and his message and how he's going to grow and keep continuing to grow.
Now, Jason is a poet who, as you said, you write books for people who don't read books. Yeah. Is this a play for people who don't go to the theater?
It's largely a play for all ages, all races, all genders to come and try to figure out how they can fit into the picture of helping another person who might be out there struggling for help, trying to struggle his way through life. And maybe they could open their eyes just for a little bit and see if they were to just reach out and hand a person a book one day or hand a person a piece of paper and a pencil, it could change their life and change their outlook and change the whole structure of society for that matter.
Now, did you actually ever really enter into gang life yourself?
Well, Mighty wouldn't let me. I was only 6 years old, and he wouldn't let them jump me in because they were all 17, 18, 20 years old, and I was just a little kid. So Mighty would never let me be jumped in, so I couldn't officially be called a gang member because I wasn't jumped in.
And why wouldn't he let you?
I was just too young, and he saw...
But I mean, when you got older.
Right. I think he saw the... He saw the advantages of me being half white, Coyote, half white, half Mexican. He saw the advantages because he would tell me, go tell me what the white people are doing. And then he would come back and he'd say, go tell the white people what we're doing.
But and if you were on the inside, you wouldn't have that freedom?
Right, I would have been tattooed on my face, my neck would have been tattooed, I would have been shooting people, and my innocence, that the little bit of innocence that I had would have been stripped from me very quickly.
Was he, I mean, besides it being a practical thing for him, do you think he saw that part of you that was the poet and was protecting you?
In the grander scheme of things and the universal activity and however you want to say it, I think so. But it might have been unconscious or subconscious.
What is the nature of the gang world such as it is here in Santa Fe, New Mexico?
What is the nature of it?
Yeah.
I think it's just a place for young kids to go who don't have a family. And that's what happened to me is... My brother was older than me. My sister was older than me. By the time I got old enough to walk around the house by myself, they were already out experiencing their own life, and I was by myself. So I wandered the streets looking for somebody to hang out with, and it happened to be the people that I found at the park, the people in the gang.
Where did you actually grow up?
I grew up in right next to the Kirk in Albuquerque. It's right by the airport. It's an isolated little community far, far away from everybody else, and police don't even drive down the street on the way to the park.
To what extent are the activities of gangs reported? I was talking to somebody just yesterday who works with young people in Albuquerque and said that there's shootings all the time that never even make it into the newspaper.
Yeah, if they reported all the gang violence and all the gang shootings that went on, the public wouldn't feel safe.
We shouldn't feel safe.
Right, well, if the public knew the amount of activity that has taken place in the shadow of society, if you would, then... Nobody would really feel safe about it, you know, and it's just a survival technique. It's just what they're doing to get by. It's just the way that the niche that they've found to be able to succeed just a little bit, even if it's in the darkness. And so, you know, they're just doing what they got to do.
If I could just add a little bit on just the whole topic of the gang theme. I've mentioned before to a lot of kids that I've worked with and also to other people in the play and whatnot, but primarily, I think, and Jason touches on this in the play, is there's a bigger issue at hand here, and it's called socioeconomic depravity, meaning the lack of opportunities for a lot of minority cultures in particular, especially young men who sometimes don't have the kind of role models. Like, in other words, you know, this play and in Jason's life, the father was missing. And this is rampant, not only in our own Hispanic community, but through the African-American community. And so I think it's very hypocritical, though, that how we designate a lot of young men of color as gangs or gang activity when we have armies, when we have police organizations, when we have American corporations that are not considered gangsters by any means, but yet they're probably 10 times more violent and very well organized and more armed. And as far as implementing that kind of violence, that goes under the radar as well. And we're meant to feel safe by that kind of aggression, and then instead it's focused on those who don't have the kind of social economic opportunities to cover that up with an Ivy League education or to cover it up with the excuse of, you know, taking oil from another country, i.e. Iraq or something like that.
I suppose if you were living in Fallujah, you might have a different view of who the gangsters were.
Exactly.
For sure.
I think another thing that enters into it is the lack of reading an article not too long ago about the direct relationship between the cutting of public recreation programs and the rise of gangs. So in other words, even people who are maybe on the lower end of the social or economic spectrum, if there are actual things to do, that makes a big difference.
For sure, for sure. And, you know, you could have a two-person gang. You could have one guy say to another guy, let's go break in the houses every night, or let's go break into cars and steal car stereos every night, and then they form their own gang. You know, so, I mean, it goes across the board. If there's nothing to do, then they're going to find something to do, whether it's positive or negative, whether it's helpful or destructive, they're going to do it.
I can recall one time here in Santa Fe, in particular, when my mother was mayor back in the mid-90s, that they actually had it on legislation that if there were two or more kids in their teens, primarily of Hispanic background, with baggy clothes, wearing black, they could be considered a gang. I mean,
legislation.
The actual language. Of
I assume it didn't pass.
It didn't pass. They were proposing that.
There are constitutional questions.
Yeah, thank God it didn't pass.
Yeah, but then again, that gets into people's prejudices also about the clothes you wear, and then there's a lot of, you know, little suburban kids who are wannabes, and they start dressing in that way as well.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's very appealing because there's a lot of freedom in the gang life. There's a lot of push for people to go into gangs, whether, you know, you realize it or not. It's saying to the poor people of the world, the impoverished people of the world, you're supposed to be in a gang. And it's saying to the people that have a little better status in life, you're supposed to go to college. So the people that are joining these gangs are doing what they feel like they're supposed to be doing. Instead of saying, let's go to college, they're saying, let's go hang out at the block and learn how to slang coke, you know, or whatever.
Now, when you know, in your work, are you, in your way, trying to help people see other options besides that?
Yeah, that's what the play is based on, basically, is the power of literature in a person's life. There's a point in the play where the lead, Emiliano, who's Angelo plays, says, how can this piece of paper change me? You know, and he's looking at this piece of paper in a book. And that was supposed to be a pivotal point in the character's transformation, is all of a sudden the words on this piece of paper changed the way that he felt about himself.
Now, you studied with the poet Jimmy Santiago Baca.
That's true.
How did you find each other?
On the internet, believe it or not. I emailed him a couple of my poems, and he decided that he wanted to work with me because he saw a little bit of disparity. He saw a little bit of... He could tell that I was in a bad place, and he could help me with just saying a few nice words about my writing and encouraging me to keep reading. And so he was able to do that for me.
And so that relationship still continues?
Oh, yeah. He's coming to the play on Friday. I'm not supposed to say anything.
You just did.
And also, we have a little line from the play that says, oh, snap. And anybody coming to the door and saying, oh, snap, will receive a half-price ticket.
Oh, snap.
Oh, snap.
Anybody. What does that mean?
It's part of the play. When he realizes he's gotten himself into something, he uses the street slang terminology for, oh, no, you know, oh, snap.
Oh, snap. Okay.
So if you come to the door and say that, you get a half-price ticket for the next 3 days, Friday,
excellent.
Saturday, Sunday.
So Friday and Saturday, it's at the Armory for the Arts at 7 in the evening.
Yes, ma'am.
And then on Sunday at 2 in the afternoon, the Armory for the Arts Theater is at 1050 Old Pecos Trail. People can make reservations by calling 984-1370. Tell us a little bit about the music in the play.
Oh, yeah, my friend Jimmy Baca, believe it or not, his name is Jimmy Baca also.
He's different Jimmy Baca.
Correct, and his stage name is DJ Jimmy B. And right as soon as I was trying to figure out how I was going to incorporate the sounds of the city, the gang life with the rap music and all these beats and whatnot, I figured right away I thought of him. He's been spinning on the turntable since 1986, you know, so he's well adept at getting the right sound. He knows sounds from just one piece of music from Louis Armstrong and all these things, so he fit in perfectly. With
and he's DJing live?
Yeah, live DJ. He puts the records on, he hits the little sound bite, he flips it over, puts another record on, hits the little sound bite.
And there's young poets in the play as well.
Yes, we have a live poetry slam, and we invited people from the community to come in and slam and say their poetry, and it's open to all ages, so anybody out there who wants to come in and say a poem, you can come in, get a half-price ticket, and come on in and say your words.
And this is all Little Ghost. Angela Jaramillo is the actor playing Little Ghost. Jason Yersick is the poet and playwright of this play. Thank you both so much for being here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for
you,
the time.
Thank you, Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Peggy Lee. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Adios.